G'day, it's good to be back in beautiful UTS. Some of you may have heard of or remember the great old boxer as he is now, Muhammad Ali. And he was once interviewed, and the interviewer asked him an interesting question, which was rare, which was if he could be anywhere in human history at any time in human history, where and when would he like to be? And at this stage, he was a member of what's called the Nation of Islam. So he was a Muslim, a particularly American form of Islam, and he gave a really interesting answer, and it was quite surprising. He said, "I would like to be outside the tomb of Jesus on Easter Sunday morning to see what really happened." That's an intriguing answer, isn't it? Because you could have think of all the number of moments in Muhammad's life. He could have said, "I would have liked to have been at that battle or at that moment or whatever else." But no, he says, "I'd like to be outside Jesus' tomb on Easter Sunday morning to see what really happened." And of course, you know that if he was a well-educated Muslim, he wouldn't have wanted to be there because, according to Surah 4, Jesus didn't even die. But that's where he wanted to be, outside the tomb of Jesus. Why do you think he chose that? Of all the things, to be outside the tomb of Jesus, where allegedly he came back from the dead. A different sort of man, but a man nonetheless, Professor C.E.M. Joad, a quite well-known English philosopher in the middle part of the 20th century. And he was not a Christian for most of his life, and he was asked who he would like to meet with from history. And he said this: "I would like to meet Jesus of Nazareth and ask him the most important question in the world." Now again, this guy's not a Christian, or he wasn't then. "I'd like to meet Jesus, ask him the most important question in the world: did you or did you not rise from the dead?" Now, this is a phone of mine. I told it to shut up, but it's still going to whir at me, so just ignore it. Go away. So here's two very interesting men who answer this question about where they'd like to be, who they'd like to talk to in terms of Jesus and his resurrection. Now, what's the big deal? Why do you think they might have chosen that? There are a couple of reasons. Which I would suggest. One is that if you know anything much about Jesus, whether you trust him and follow him or not, but if you know something about the man of history, a couple of times he gets challenged by the religious people of his day to give some sort of verification or evidence that he really was who he claimed to be. Now, give us some proof. Come on, you make these big claims, and he did make terrifyingly big claims. Give us some evidence. In John chapter 2, he has just done something which no other man that we know of in history had done, certainly no Jewish man had ever done. We dared to call God my Father. Now, a lot of people don't get the significance. A friend was saying to me, why would they have not called God Father? I said, well, because what they knew was that God was this massively powerful, the creator of the ends of the universe, the judge of all, not Father, but much more powerful and austere and transcendent than that. So Jesus just dared to call God. He just dared to clean the temple out as if it was his home. And they said, remember his answer? He said, "Tear apart this temple," speaking of his body, "and in 3 days' time, I will rebuild it." Then he leaves them. The evidence, he says, is that in the tearing apart of his body, in 3 days' time, he'll be back. In Matthew 12, he gets asked a similar question by a different group of cranky religious officials. And he speaks about being in the belly of the earth for a couple of days and then rising again. So Jesus has this consistency of his idea that the proof of his claim to be not just a prophet, not just an enlightened man, but actually the Son of God who's come from above, is he ties it to his resurrection. Historically, it's interesting that he uses different pictures to verify this idea. And we know that the early Christians, in one of perhaps the earliest bit of Christian writing we have, 1 Corinthians, the apostle there says that if Jesus Christ hasn't been raised from the dead, we're of all men in the world the most to be pitied. Your faith in him is worthless. You are still in your sins. And we are found to be liars about God because we testified that God raised him from the dead. Jesus and the earliest Christians all understood that Christianity hangs or falls on an event. Not an idea that you may or may not agree with. Because frankly, that you or I agree with a religious idea is worth what? Well, it's of psychological interest, but in terms of having a handle on what's real, it's not very significant. Jesus claims to be the one person who knows, and then he says it all hangs on this one event. Which is why I think it behoves anyone who fancies themselves as being moderately engaged in thoughtful belief whether Christian or not, to have a look at this question of the resurrection. Did he really rise from the dead? But then you might say, well, how can anyone who's a modern, intelligent, well-educated person even come close to believing such a self-evidently stupid idea? But then you don't have to be a well-educated modern person. You can be a moderately uneducated ancient person. And everybody knows that when you're dead, you're dead. You're a long time dead. In fact, they didn't have these magic things that you could get whacking on this person's chest and they come back from the dead. I've just finished watching Lost. It's taken me a long time. I'm always a couple of years behind the latest trend. But I watched it. My ex-UTS daughter urged me to watch it. We had a lot of fun watching it. And I have no idea what it was about, but it was good fun. But I noticed that about 2 out of every 3 people who die in that show come back from the dead. Not miraculously, because someone thumps them on the chest, kisses them on the lips. And so we're much more liable to believe that someone can come back from the dead than back in the old days. Right? And actually, when Christianity headed out from Jerusalem, which it did very quickly, into the Greek world, the fundamentally Greek cultural world, the Greeks had a very clear view on resurrection, that is, dead bodies coming back. A number of their poetic statements, and in their most famous law court in Athens itself, they have this affirmation, this statement. There is no resurrection from the dead. Right? Oh, souls floating off into some sort of thing, yes, but not a dead body coming back. Ancient people like modern people, we all have the same experience. When you're dead, you're dead. And it's just sort of chronological snobbery and fundamental ignorance when people say, oh, well, they could believe it, but of course we can't, we're ever so terribly clever. That's nonsense. It's always been a nonsense to believe. It didn't help Christianity's cause that it had at its central belief, not an interesting view about God, although it had some interesting views and some quite beautiful views and quite unique views about the loveliness of God, but it had news of a fact. So when the Apostle Paul preaches about Jesus in Athens, it's going all very well when he's talking about God, but as soon as he mentions the resurrection, what happens? They all crack up in laughter. What a moron. Now, we all know there's no resurrection from the dead, but the Christians insisted on this because it was always the heart of everything. But one of the intriguing things is the number, particularly of lawyers and historians, who deal in this sort of question of evidence and good evidence, who, when they have addressed their minds to the evidence, are persuaded. There's interesting books, like one I remember reading a couple of years ago, Leading Lawyers Look at the Evidence of the Resurrection. And really top-class judges and professors of law look at various aspects of the evidence and why they're persuaded. But perhaps the most interesting one, and I don't tell you this because this guy believes you should believe, but just to try and debunk the notion that some people have, and it often gets, in fact, I was on one of those sort of useless internet exchanges about Jesus and that, where just I'm thinking, man, I'm old and I'm nowhere near as narrow-minded as the guy I was arguing with, but the silly things that kept getting said. But Pinchas Lapid, if any of you have got a friend who's pregnant or you're pregnant, you're looking for a name, try Pinchas, okay? You'll find that there won't be many people with that name. It's good to be special. But Pinchas Lapid was a very eminent historian. He's died only recently. German by origin, but spent quite a bit of his time in universities in Israel. He was an Orthodox Jewish man. He'd written a number of books that were embarrassing to a particular part of the Christian church for its behavior during the Second World War. No great friend, in a sense, of Christianity, although a very respectable and polite man. He, in the end, turned his enormous skill to look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And in 1984, he released a short book that exploded in the intellectual world because here is an Orthodox Jew. Now, the reason I keep stressing that is this is not a man who's got some cultural family bias towards believing bad evidence because it backs up his family belief. This man is not just a Jew like many of my friends I grew up with. When I became a Christian, I used to joke with them, I'm more Jewish than you blokes. I at least know who Abraham is. I didn't have a clue. But this guy's an Orthodox Jew, like really serious. In the end, he writes this book called The Resurrection of Jesus, and part of the sort of conclusion is this. He says this, I quote, I accept the resurrection of Jesus not as an invention of the community of disciples, but as an historical event. Now, that you can see where that caused a ruckus, because normally a person who comes to that conclusion you would think would become Christian. And there was this terrific concern about this Orthodox, one of the most eminent historians in Israel. But he said when he looked at the evidence, it's basically an invention of the disciples or an event that changed the disciples. when he looked, now, you may be unpersuaded, most of my family is unpersuaded, but they won't look at the evidence. And if you say, oh, that's ridiculous, it's like someone who hears something about quantum mechanics, which is silly when you hear about it, and goes, oh, that's a lot of baloney, I'm a scientific person, I don't believe that particles are in two places at one time, and all that sort of stuff, but that's because they haven't looked at the evidence. So cleverness without evidence is worth nothing. So again, I'm not saying you should believe because Pinkas believes, but I'm saying it's just a nonsense. It's counter the facts to say modern clever people can't. Now, what was it that persuaded Pinkas and many others, you know, much less eminent people like myself, that this is actually true, that actually if you'd been outside the tomb of Jesus with a camera going, you could have actually seen, you know, Jesus alive and well. Well, let's have a look at some of the evidence. Tomorrow, I understand you've got Chris Forbes, a really world-class ancient historian who'll be lecturing on some of the evidence. Much better to listen to him than me. So even if you have a lecture during that lunchtime, just take it off. All right? I'm sure you'll take off lectures for other less good reasons. Just get the notes from someone else and don't quote me on that. But if you ever miss a lecture, tomorrow's would be a good one to miss, to hear him. Now, let's have a look at John 20. I wish I had time to spend time going through the background to the quality of this man as a witness. Suffice it to say that in the last 100 years, people have gone from thinking this is an interesting book of theological speculation to the fact that it's very high quality eyewitness material. And you'll see that even in some of the silly details, if I can say that about this witness. He has some silly details that he doesn't put in, and some major details which any decent story would put in, but they don't put in. And hopefully we'll come to it. Now, I'm travelling fairly fast. I'd like to stop and ask for questions, but sorry. I'm going to be like this terrible lecturer out of theology college. In his first lecture, he said, any questions? Good. Keep them until the end of fourth term, which I didn't think was very helpful. But I will hang around for as long as you like after this if you'd like to tease out some of these questions personally. Let's have a look at the first witness, because this whole Christianity thing is built on witnesses. Let's have a look at, you've got the text there in front of you. I'll just work our way through it. Look at what was it that persuaded the first Christians that the ridiculous had happened. Early on the first day of the week, that's Sunday, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she sees something. She's coming up to the tomb, and the stone, which was a common way for rich people to be buried, and Jesus was buried in the rich man's tomb. The guy took sympathy on him. They have stones as doorways that they roll away. They roll it across. She gets there, and she finds that the door is open. She doesn't actually look into the tomb at this point, but she comes to a conclusion, and it's a natural enough conclusion, a best inference, if you like. Verse 2, so she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciples there in a house with the doors locked, etc., the one Jesus loved, and said, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him. So she sees that the tomb has been interfered with. She comes to a logical conclusion, that is, that the people who had murdered him with torture beforehand have continued to mock him and to attack him by desecrating his grave. Sadly, that happens in history sometimes. Some of the interesting figures of history, some of them my great heroes, were dug up long after they died and their bodies were butchered by people who didn't like what they stood for. It's a crazy thing to do, we might think, but it has happened and it still happens. So she thinks that's her deduction. She doesn't go, oh, my goodness, something's happened to the tomb. Resurrection. Right? It just was so far out of the ballpark, any more than any other sensible person would. So she rips back to the blokes. Verse 3. So she's the first witness. We'll come back to her. The second witness is Peter and the other disciple. Most scholars think the disciple is John's way of talking about himself. I think that makes good sense. Verse 3. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running. The other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. Who gives a fig about who arrived there first? But it's the sort of detail you put if you are there. It's like there's all sorts of crazy little details around the death of, like the man who ran away naked, nearly captured by the Romans. Who cares? If you believe the Son of God's about to be executed, fascinatingly important to discover there was a young man roaming around Jerusalem with no clothes on. It's told us in Mark's Gospel, almost certainly that was Mark. That's what most historians think. You just remember crazy details like that. John remembers he got to the tomb first. He doesn't go in. Jews didn't like going into a place where dead bones for all sorts of good reasons. He has a look in. He bent over and looked in, and isn't what he notices? He notices the strips of linen lying there. Now, why is that significant? The strips of linen that was Jesus probably wrapped in a cloth head to toe and then sort of bound up with a separate thing around the head, which they would tie up to hold your jaw up so it didn't fall open, because later on when they did stuff with the bones, you know, a year or two later, it didn't look so nice if you came in and the guy had his mouth open like he was screaming. So they tended to keep them shut with a separate bit of cloth. He notices the strips of linen. Why is that significant? Well, we'll come back to it. It's worth thinking about. Verse 6, then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. I like Simon Peter. He is a big mouth and he is impetuous, and big mouth people who don't think long like me, we like this guy. Simon Peter came along, although it was very un-Jewish, straight in he goes to the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying. Who cares? It shows that the empty tomb isn't quite empty, doesn't it? Because you'll hear Christians talk about the empty tomb. It is one of the two great facts that people need to explain, that the body of Jesus is missing, but the tomb's not quite empty. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, they never tell us the significance. We get the fact that it registers on John, and it registers on, here's the significance. Just think about it. If you're going to steal a body, a dead body, are you first going to unwrap it? Wouldn't you be thankful it was wrapped? You know, you're looking in the fridge and you can find a sort of a hamburger or something like that. It's been there for 7 months and it's getting a bit liquefied. Wouldn't you be pleased it was wrapped in glad wrap? The first thing you wouldn't do would be to unwrap it, then handle this thing. No one who's stealing a body would unwrap the... It's interesting, they don't tell you what to think. They just let you to think. No one who's stealing a body unwraps it first. You're thankful it's wrapped and you carry it and you do whatever you're doing with it. But they notice that the wrappings are still there and that the headpiece is separate. Now, John tells us that at that point he believed. And he says in verse 8, finally the other disciple, that's him, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside, he saw and believed. This is the first guy who seems to have believed that Jesus may have risen from the dead. But interestingly, he didn't believe it sufficiently to tell anyone. There's no record that he told Peter, that he told the other disciples. He just seems to have come to the conclusion. He did say he was going to die, which we didn't believe, because how could a guy as powerful as him die? Therefore, we never took seriously what he said next, which is going to rise from the dead. The body's missing, clearly. People haven't stolen it. People suggest it's possible that what he's seen is a bit like a chrysalis where a bug comes out of it. It might just sort of collapse, you know, like the body's gone through it and it's just there. But either way, John comes to some sort of soft belief that Jesus has risen. Peter, on the other hand, has no idea what's going on. Verse 10, the other disciples went back to where they were staying. We're actually told in Luke's gospel that Peter went back wondering. Not wondering like, but wondering like, what the heck's going on? That sort of, he's puzzled. Peter, he's seen part of the evidence. He's seen the empty tomb, or the mostly empty tomb, without which Christianity couldn't have survived for a second. Even people like a guy called Mr. Ludermann, a guy who's written a book about 10 years ago, having a go at the question of the resurrection. He says, like anyone, Professor Vermes from Oxford University, a Jewish professor of New Testament, they all say the tomb was obviously empty. Christianity couldn't have survived for a second in Jerusalem if the tomb, something's happened to the body. Because the Christians didn't go and preach this in Rome. But back in Jerusalem, they preached it in Jerusalem. And within weeks, they were being beaten as the authorities tried to silence them. The tomb is mostly empty. So that's the second witnesses. We'll come back to them. They don't really believe yet. Now we come back to Mary, verse 11. Poor old Mary. She goes to the tomb. She runs back to tell the boys that something terrible has happened. They run, so she presumably follows them. They have a look in the tomb. They leave. She's just arrived. So that's the story to now. Verse 11. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb. This is a nightmare, isn't it? I mean, someone who you love has been killed and now their body has been desecrated. Tears are the only sensible response for a man or a woman. She looked into the tomb for the first time and she saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. And some of you, oh, here we go, this crap about angels. This is the trouble with religious people. They think angels are flipping around everywhere. Give me a break. Actually, that's not what the Bible thinks. The Bible thinks seeing angels is really, really, really rare. The sort of time they turn up is at the birth of Jesus and at the resurrection of Jesus. To my knowledge, angels did not sing in the skies when I was born. I don't think they're going to sing at any other particular time or hang around. But if it's possible, just hypothetically, that Jesus really is this once in cosmic history visit by God himself to our planet, it makes some sense. If there were going to be spiritual beings singing a song, that they'd do it at his birth. And if they're going to be anywhere else, to be at the tomb of Jesus, it would make sense if the story is true. Nothing's made of it. She sees them. She doesn't see flappy wings. She just sees them as people. They said to her, "Woman, why are you crying?" It's a good question. Because they know it's a happy day. You know, death has finally been beaten by someone. Right? Not just avoided for a few seconds as you can with good cancer therapy and other things like that, but it's actually been ripped apart. So they know it's a happy day, but she doesn't yet. "Woman, why are you crying?" See, she comes out with her conclusion again. I think I like that Mary, she's consistent. Three times in this story she's going to tell you she knows what's happened. These mongrels have taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've put him. At this she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but didn't realize it was Jesus. Now this is another one of the things, and this happens once or twice in the resurrection stories, that if I was writing them, I wouldn't have told you, because I'm a much better writer of propaganda than they are. Right? It doesn't help the story, does it? That once or twice people meet Jesus, here Mary, and later on in Luke's gospel, two guys meet him at the end of the day. They're walking and Jesus comes along beside them and walks. They don't recognize him until they're inside having dinner together. Why would you do that? I mean, it doesn't help the story. It gives people all sorts of excuses, like silly excuses, like Mr. Luderman's excuse for the explanation for the resurrection of Jesus is he had a twin separated at birth. There's no evidence for this in history, but don't let that get in the way. It's like a Gilbert and Sullivan story, really. And he gets separated, and then he goes up somewhere else, and he turns up in Jerusalem by accident on the very day after Jesus dies. Right? And that's why they thought it was him. Right? And that's why they weren't quite sure it was him, because he had his hair done slightly differently. You know, it's like an Egyptian style rather than a Palestinian style, or wherever it was he was brought up. I tell you, he didn't recognize Jesus. Although I think we're given... Actually, let me tell you a story. This is a true story. I had an experience like this with my brother. I'm at North Sydney Station. I'm reading some notes for a meeting I've got to have in the city. People everywhere. I'm not looking at anyone in particular, but I'm not. I don't have my eyes shut. Standing beside me is a man in a suit. On this side is a man in a suit. We get on the train at North Sydney Station. We sit down. I sit down next to this man in a suit. And then a lot of people get on at Milsons Point, I think it's the next stop. We all had to shuffle along. At which point, I looked at the man next to me, and it was my brother. I'd shared a bedroom with this bloke for a decade. And I just hadn't recognized him because I wasn't expecting to see him. I wasn't really looking in people's faces. I was otherwise occupied. So he put out his hand and said, "Hello, my name's Ross Powell." I said, "Oh, hello, my name's Ian Powell. Nice to meet you." And it was just, and it was a helpful thing because I realized it is possible if you're not expecting to see someone and you're not looking them in the face to be right next to someone and not see them. This is exactly what's happened for Mary. There's actually a little line where it says in verse 16, she turned toward him. Which is just a little point that indicates she wasn't looking at him. She was in his vicinity. She comes out with her mantra again, because Jesus says to her, verse 13, "Woman, why are you crying?" Verse 15. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, which makes sense. It's early in the morning and they're in a garden. Thinking he was the gardener, she says again, "Sir, if you carried him away, tell me where you put him and I'll go and get him." So same mantra. She's got her logical deduction. Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which is a word that means not just, it's not as formal as rabbi, it's like my rabbi. It's a personal, intimate word. And so it's the way Jesus says her name that gets through the tears. In the same way, frankly, my dad's been dead for 10 years, and if I suddenly heard him say Ian, I would recognize his voice, and I'd be freaked, frankly. I'm not expecting to see him for a while yet. But there is just something about someone who knows you, who you've been with, and the way they say your name. She recognizes him by the way she speaks. She turns to him. Look at verse 17. Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me." Literally in the Greek it says, "Stop clinging to me." It's a word to say that there's an action that started that must be stopped. We're not told here in the sort of rendition of the story, but we're told by Jesus' words that she has grabbed hold of him, which makes perfect good sense, doesn't it? Someone who you've lost through death, you think his body's been desecrated, and suddenly he's alive, would be exactly the thing you'd do. You'd grab hold and as if you're never going to let go. Jesus says, "Stop holding me." Not that there's anything wrong with holding him, but he's got a job for it to do. "Go to my brothers and tell them," etc. Verse 18, Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news I have seen the Lord. She's gone from, there are two chunks of evidence that convince the early Christians. The body is missing, which cries out for some sort of explanation. The second is the appearances, the experience of seeing Jesus. And notice this is probably the first genuinely Christian sermon preached by this gal. I have seen the Lord. Not, I've got a sense that perhaps goodness will triumph over evil, or perhaps life will triumph over death. Because what the whole Jesus story teaches you is it doesn't matter how good you are, you lose. Good guys come last. Death always has the last word. Your life from the time you were born has been heading to a grave. Everyone you love is heading to a grave. The whole universe is heading ultimately to a grave. This is a terrible, tragic universe in the end. We just have culture that teaches not to think about that and just to get drunk and get a career and just don't think about the one thing you can't escape. But she's had this experience. She said, I've seen the Lord. Right? It's the first Christian sermon. Interestingly, we don't have time to look at this, although I'd love to. It's interesting that Jesus chooses to appear to Mary. It's not as if she found him when he was sneaking around the garden trying to hide. Right? He appears to whom he wills. It's very interesting that Jesus chooses to appear, first of all, to Mary. It's hard for us to get this. I hope if you've been thoroughly had the best fruits of feminism that you realize that men and women are thoroughly equal, etc., etc., etc. I've got a relative who thinks that women are not just equal but far better, but I'm not quite sure if that's not sexism either. But nonetheless, that's another issue. But it's interesting because you would have thought, who would Jesus appear to? Well, it'd appear to Peter, the bloke, the leader of the early Christian church, or John, the disciple. He seemed to have a particular sort of, you know, those people you meet, you just get on with. They're on your wavelength, as John and Jesus were. No, he appears to a woman. Now, I'm not saying woman because I think that's particularly wrong, but in the culture of that day, both the Jewish and the Greek culture, if you're making up a story, I tell you what you don't have. You don't have a woman as your chief first witness. Right? In fact, if all you've got is women as your witnesses, you ain't got a case. Now, you might say, some people say, oh, this is a clever trick the Christians have played. They're so cunning, they've made up a lie that would be completely useless until you get to sort of Western culture at the end of the 20th century. So up until then, we've just had a really dumb argument that's been turned, and it has. The early Christians got mocked. We were mocked often by the Roman intellectuals as a religion for women, which I'm sorry to say was a put down, and slaves. That gives you an idea of what they thought. Because of this, the view it had of women. And you've got Jesus chooses to appear to a woman. Right? In fact, in the early days, Mary was called the apostle to the apostles. The first Christian sermon. Now, without a doubt, the church is sexist, and we mightn't like that, like every other organization tends to be. But the fact is that Jesus clearly wasn't, unlike many other founders of great religions. He sends a woman to preach to the boys, and she does. We have seen the Lord. So what convinces Mary? Right? She saw him. When the body was missing, she knew something terrible had happened. But actually something wonderful had happened, which she was only persuaded of when she saw him. And Christianity is about news before it's about views. So let's have a look at the second bunch of witnesses. Mary is the chief and first witness. She believed because she saw. What she believes is that she saw. He was alive. Well, the second witnesses, as you heard read, on the evening of the first day of the week, and I love the fact Jesus left them waiting about 10 hours with this witness of a woman, which they, well, we're told in Luke they thought it was just nonsense, old wives' tales. But Jesus turns up, verse 19, doors were locked for fear of the Jewish leaders because they would have thought that having wiped out the head, they'd probably go and get the lieutenants, etc. That's what normally happened when a revolution was put down. They're hiding. Jesus turns up. Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. After this, he showed them his hands and his side, which does make it a little difficult to believe it was Jesus' twin. But so desperate have atheistic scholars got that they don't have a theory for the resurrection. They know something happened, but all the theories have been tried over the last 300 years. They keep popping up again and again as if nothing's been said. But Jesus says, look, it's me. Here's where the spear went. Here's where the nails went. It really is me. And the disciples are overjoyed. They are beside themselves because they've seen him. They can't believe it. They can't make much sense of it. But they know he's alive. Right? He has done as he said. He has conquered death. Well, why did they believe? Because they saw. That's what convinced them. But as you know, Thomas wasn't there. So now say that there's 11 people on the planet that believe. Mary, the 10 disciples, minus Judas is dead, sadly. Thomas wasn't there. We don't know why Thomas wasn't there. That's why I think it's always good to go to church. You never know who's going to turn up. Thomas wasn't there. Now, Thomas, known as Didymus, he was a twin. Didymus means twin, unlike Jesus. Jesus Didymus. I don't think so. Thomas was one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So he said exactly what I think you'd say. Nah, I'm not going to believe it. Because they, you see how they plagiarized the woman's sermon? They don't even footnote it. We've seen the Lord, they say. Right? Again, news, not views. He said exactly, I think, you got to love Thomas. Unless I see the nail marks in his hand and put my finger where the nail went and put my hand in the side, I will not believe. Right? He said, you guys may have all eaten some funny mushrooms. You guys, we don't know what's happened to you blokes, but I know what's real. And I ain't believing it. And I think Thomas never thought it was going to happen. It's the sort of thing you say, you know, I'll eat my hat. You know, I'll crawl from Redfern to Annandale where I live, as South Sydney win the premiership this year. Although I do hope they will. But I've been hoping since, was it 1971 or something, the last time we won? It's been a long time. But, you know, it's the sort of statement you make that you know it ain't going to happen, you know. So Thomas is... So he's got this group of friends, led by this woman, saying, he's alive, we've seen him, and Thomas knows dead people don't come back. And he's not believing. It may be he's saying, I don't believe what you saw, I only believe what I see, which is kind of dumb in the end. You know when people say, I only believe what I see? At that point, they're doing one of two things. They're either lying or they're really stupid. Right? Because most of what we believe, we haven't seen. I believe that Betty Powell's my mother. I didn't see it, or if I did see it, it was such an inside view I can't remember, right? And yet I have not the slightest fragment of a doubt that this woman I'm going to see this afternoon, Betty Powell, is my mother. Captain Cook landed in Australia in 1770, Arthur Phillips in 1788. There was a war at about 1914 somewhere in Europe. I haven't seen it. Oh, I've seen pictures. You genius. I've seen the world attack numerous times in movies like Independence Day. Much more realistic than the silly films I've seen of D-Day. Can't believe we've just seen a film, for crying out loud. We all know that man didn't land on the moon because that was all done by trick photography. I do believe man landed on the moon, okay? But, you know, most of what you actually believe, almost all the science you believe, you've never done an experiment. We believe it on the basis of trustworthy witnesses. That's how humans live, right? But Thomas says, I'm not going to believe unless I see it. Now, this, again, is one of the things I've been puzzling about and enjoying. A week later, his disciples in house again, Thomas is with them. The doors were locked. Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. A week. I love the fact. I don't know quite what it means that Jesus left them for a week arguing the toss with the boys all trying to convince Thomas. Thomas going, nah, nah. And you know how it is when you argue with someone, you just don't argue yourself into a corner, really. The way to not convince someone, sadly, is to argue with them, but you've got very little choice often if you think it's true. But Thomas, it's 8 days later, Jesus leaves them with this. It's their first attempt, I think, at trying to convince people in the world that Jesus is risen. And they're learning, this is not going to be an easy sell, boys. People don't like to believe this sort of stuff. Jesus turns up. Verse 27, he says to Thomas, he presumably goes over to Thomas and says, look, Thomas, put your finger in the hole there. You want to do that? Here's where the spear went. Stick your hand in. All right? Just for goodness sake, believe. Now notice what Jesus, he's being an empiricist, isn't he? There are some times when the only way to believe something is to see it. Right? There are many times where it isn't. But Thomas is not being, Jesus doesn't say, oh Thomas, you really should learn to believe in spite of evidence. Faith is about believing what you know is baloney. Right? That's the sort of definition silly old Richard Dawkins has. It's a definition he should be ashamed of. He's been communicated with for over 15, 20 years by other scholars from Oxford University saying, Christians have never believed that's what faith is. Find a mainline Christian who believes that we don't. Faith is not about believing what you know to be nonsense, and the more stupid it is, the holier the faith is. Faith is about deciding to trust someone. So Jesus basically comes up and offers him empirical, stick your finger in the hole. Just for goodness sake, get with the truth. Realize what's happened. Believe. And that's what he says to him. And Thomas doesn't seem to take advantage of the moment he's given. There's no evidence that he actually went, oh, and there you go. I think he was persuaded by seeing, although we do know other times that some of the disciples did touch him. Verse 28, Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Now, this is an extraordinary statement. My Lord and my God. John has done what a lot of Jewish documents do. If you go back to the very beginning of John, he tells you that Jesus is God. And then he leaves us watching Jesus interacting with people as they try to make out, who is this bloke? What's going on here? How can we make sense of this bloke? And right at the end, you get the conclusion, which you were given at the beginning anyhow, where Thomas goes, oh, goodness. Not what a fine prophet you are. It's much more than being a prophet. Right? This is someone who has said, I will take on death, I will let it swallow me, and I'll rip its guts out. I will defeat death. I'll beat death and come back. Right? Not just avoid death with some clever therapy. I'll let the beast eat me as it eats every single person. Right? It ate Confucius, it ate Zoroaster, it ate Moses, it ate Muhammad, it ate all these great and wonderful people. Ate them all. Right? Ate the Buddha. Jesus, it eats him and it gets torn to pieces. As he promised. Twice, at least we know, in John 2 and in Matthew 12. And what Thomas seems to do is, because if you read through the Gospels, there's this whole question that the first Christians were struggling with before they became Christians, was that they know Jesus is a man. That's pretty obvious. They know he's a man. Right? That's what he is. He's a man. Right? He goes to the bathroom, he has to eat, he gets tired, he sleeps. He's a man. But then he keeps doing things that they've got no category for. So he says to people, your sins are forgiven. And the religious people of his day rightly say, only God can forgive sins. Who do you think you are? This is blasphemy, which is in the end why he was killed. We're running out of time, so I can't give you too many examples. But the other classic one is where Jesus is in a boat with a bunch of fishermen and a few others, and it's a nasty storm comes up on the Sea of Galilee, and these professional fishermen think they're going to die. It's so vicious. And they wake Jesus up, who's asleep. He's tired from having done a lot of hard work the day before. And he stands up and says to the wind, well, basically the word he uses is kind of like, shut up. It's howling and screaming. Quiet. And then to the waves, he says, sit down. Silence, and the waves die down. He then turns to his disciples and he says, what are you afraid of? Do you have no faith? But then the eyewitness tells us this is what they would, but the disciples said, who is this man that even the sea and the wind obey him? And they were terrified of Jesus. They kept struggling. What category do we put Jesus into? And Thomas finally gets it right. Oh, my goodness, my Lord and my God. That's who you are. And Jesus, if he was just a prophet, at that point would have slapped Thomas around the head, but he doesn't. He takes that as a given and moves on and says, then Jesus said to him, because you've seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. He actually looks past Thomas to us and people in all sorts of different cultures and all sorts of different periods who don't get the privilege by accidents of birth to be there when he rose from the dead. But he says, I got a special blessing for those who don't get to see me yet believe. How is it possible? On this I want to finish. John tells you. Verse 30. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which is not recorded in this book. Otherwise it would have been too expensive. Paper was very expensive then. So he tells you the other things. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. You've got honest witness accounts. Explain why they believed. Again and again, when people take the time to look at it, like Pinchas Lapid, with every sociological and family reason not to believe, when he looks at the evidence, persuaded. That's what persuaded me to be Christian. And it's what persuades me that Jesus is who he says he is, the Son of God, who comes to bring us life, and who alone defeats death. Right? Fundamentally, I became a Christian so reluctantly, hating the fact it was true, thinking it was the end of life. Although Jesus says, I've come that you may have life in all its fullness. And I agree with him, it is, it's wonderful. But also, here is the one person who defeats death, right? And offers to share that with any who'll go the journey with him and travel him and trust him. You need to make a verdict. You either step back and say, you and all this story is a pack of lies, and you want to have good reasons to believe that Jesus Christ is a liar and all these early witnesses are liars because they seem like truthful men and women and they die for it. or to step forward and say, it's kind of wacky, but all the evidence points in that direction, that Jesus Christ is in fact the one who rose from the dead. And the earliest Christian statement is, we've seen the Lord, he is risen. Well, I'm going to finish there, and I'll be back on Thursday night if you can be. I want to talk more about the so what difference does it make to us that Jesus rose from the dead. It shows us who he is. And Chris Forbes is here tomorrow. Try not to miss him. He really knows his stuff. Thank you.